Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Today's ConcertCast is brought to you by PostPeakLiving.com, offering online courses that prepare you for the post-peak world. There's still time to register in the next Sustainable Post-Peak Livelihoods course, which takes place on February 20th. The course includes over 200 livelihoods and a methodology for understanding which livelihoods will succeed in a post-peak world. Find out more and register at PostPeakLiving.com. Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to the ConcertCast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand, and most recently, Big Slide, an ebook available for purchase at kunstler.com/bigslide. On January 9th, Big Slide was performed as a staged reading at the Multi-Use Community Cultural Center in Rochester, New York. We have played the recordings of the stage reading on the previous two episodes. Today's show is going to feature the question and answer session that followed the staged reading. Now, just to explain to listeners, Jim was standing in front of the microphone, but the way it was set up, I was not able to mic all the people asking the questions. So you can hear some of them pretty well, but in other instances, I'm going to cut in as the host and clarify the question for your listening convenience.
I want to thank all of you for doing a wonderful job on very short notice. Very tough. This thing got together really quickly in a matter of about 3.5 weeks. And so we haven't had very much time to put it together. And they did a yeoman's job, so thank you very much. So anybody want to ask me anything about this?
What would you do in Bloom version?
The question was, what would the doom and gloom version be like?
Well, it wouldn't have the hymn in it. The hopeful Christian hymn in the end of Act 2.
It seems like you have a lot to say with this work. I'm curious why you felt that a play was the proper medium as opposed to a book or a letter to the editor.
I did write a book, I wrote a nonfiction book about this subject, The Long Emergency. It was published in 2005, and it was about the issues behind why we're having trouble in our economy and our society. And when that was done, I decided to write a novel set in the post-petroleum American future. And that came out in 2008, and that was called World Made by Hand. And in the meantime, I decided I wanted to try kind of another dramatic medium, and so I decided to write a play. And, it really wasn't more complicated than that. I'm really not trying to, like, put a message across to inform everybody. It is, after all, it's a work of the imagination. It happens to be circumstantially about the times that we're living in or the times we may be moving into. And it's very dramatic material. You know, we're in a nation that's kind of going through a slow motion train wreck. Obviously, our situation is not as grave as the compressed events that are portrayed in this play that happened very suddenly and quickly. You know, the government is falling. There are bombs, terrorist bombs going off all within a very short period of time. So that's all compressed for the sake of, the expression, imagination.
Does this suggest that the upper class is the primary responsible?
This audience member is asking Jim if the play is suggesting that the upper class is primarily responsible for the direction our country is going in.
This isn't really a polemic against the upper classes, although there's a lot about their behavior in the last a couple of decades that's deplorable. It's really not much more than what you're seeing, you know, a family in turmoil, and a family in certain circumstances. Their circumstances are what they are. They're wealthy, they're privileged, but they're subject to a lot of terrible stuff themselves. And, you know, in a way, it's a replay of things that we've seen in history in not very distant history of our era, you know, the events of the 20th century, in particular what happened in Europe with the Nazis. And, you know, they went through a political convulsion, and the result of that political convulsion was a great deal of cruelty and injustice. And I, you know, one of the points that I did want to make was that we're not immune from that kind of outcome in this country, despite a lot of our grandiose ideas about how exceptional we are. You know, that under the right kind of stress, we could find ourselves also being cruel and unjust to people.
And given the reception you've got from theatrical companies about putting it on, are you planning to rework this as a screenplay?
That was my question.
For the Independent Film Channel or something like that?
Can I add to that?
This is Michael Arvey, the director.
The play, as it's written, is very filmic. Mm. It's very visual, particularly when you have all those things going on at the different levels. The wonderful opportunity for a screen script to have the two things happening simultaneously, which you can really accomplish much easier in a film than you can in a stage.
Well, frankly, I had no intention of, at any point, of seeing it as a film. It was always intended to be a play. One of the elements about it that, as I viewed it differently perhaps than you did, because, and for reasons that go way back. When I was what they called a drama student at Brockport State, I was,
I would never have allowed you to say drama.
You'd be surprised. I ended up focusing on directing plays, and I was very interested in directing plays. And when I wrote this play, I envisioned the characters being in a swirl of motion throughout the play. You know, people coming in on stage and going off stage, and, you know, a group here, and then they're changing and they're swirling around. And that's something that you really didn't see in this reading, and it was hard to really get the motion. Also, there's a lot of dimension to it because there's an upstairs and a downstairs, so they're moving around down here, they're going up and down, and it's a kind of a swirl of motion. I never imagined it to be a movie. If somebody wants to make a movie out of it, that's swell, but it's not something I've tried to do.
Well, Jim, not a movie, a film.
A film. You know, more disturbing, though, is the way that, and it's unfortunate, the way that, you know, the situation in regional theater is now that, you know, as I told you before we did the play, that, you know, nobody wants to do a play with more than two characters. Optimally, one character. So that every play ends up being, you know, somebody impersonating Walt Whitman or Emily Dickinson, and that's all you get, a little biographical, you know, A Night with Emily Dickinson. Nobody wants to do anything except that. And it's unfortunate. You know, we need, this was designed to be a play, you know, a classic three-act play with a lot of people in it. You know, and for me, it came out of my experience being in plays with a lot of characters. You know, when I was a drama student, we did Peter Weiss's Marat Sade, which was a tremendous swirl of a large cast of characters. We did the Cherry Orchard. Chekhov play. So that was what I wanted to do.
This next question comes from Alan O'Grady Cusio, who read the part of Charlie.
Based on what you just said, and also listening to you on WXXI, the interview you did, now, disclaimer first, I don't live in the school of biographical criticism. I'm reader response criticism. So there's where I'm coming from. Listening to you on the radio and listening to you and being in the show, I'm fascinated with character. And seeing all the scriptural references that are in this show, I'm asking you, is the name Daniel on purpose because of the prophet Daniel, and are you Daniel?
And we thought you were just a pretty face.
Dozing off, didn't you?
He's a real doctor, though.
Yeah, that's right.
Literary criticism, that's what I asked.
No, I chose the name simply, you know, it was really kind of maybe even a half-assed reference, you know, it was like Daniel in the Lion's Den kind of reference, and I wanted to get, if he was going to have a biblical name, it was going to be, of a character who had gone through some kind of tribulation. He's obviously not really a heroic character, he's a bully and a lout. But he is at least a man of action in a situation where other people are having a hard time acting at all.
Because he has several prophetic lines.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why I call.
But no, he's not meant to be a prophet. He's just meant to be an intelligent upper class guy struggling to keep his family together against a tide of complacency and an inability to pull anything together.
Kind of related question, which of the characters relate to somebody you knew personally?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, I've known lots of people. You know, I've known lots of types. I mean, when there are types all over, you know, the person who's an invalid, the person who's a drunk, the person who's a bully, the person who's a, you know, wants to make everybody feel good, you know, the girl who's a strumpet, you know, et cetera. And you did a wonderful job.
Said to Fiona Criddle, who read the part of Raven.
But, you know, for those of you who suspect that I had some kind of an idea of pedophilia involved, the character that I imagined was maybe a little bit older than this particular actress, who was excellent. She is 16, maybe a couple of years younger than I imagined the character to be, a little bit more mature. So it's not like a kind of a child thing. I didn't want you to get that idea exactly.
She's a little Lolita, yes.
So Ambrose Bierce said that a revolution is an abrupt change in the form of misgovernment.
That's a good one.
So what do you feel is next after the play? I mean, what do you envision? Yeah.
Oh, what happens in the imagined
yes.
chronology of life in the USF, you know, when the Bob Farnhams have a revolution?
Right.
Well, I don't know I don't really have that clear an idea about it. In my nonfiction and the commentary that I write on a regular basis, I sometimes refer to cornpone Nazis, cornpone Nazism as being a danger that lies down the road for us. That, you know, when we become delusional enough, and when we become distressed, you know, I think my great fear is that. And we're coming off of this 8-year period of George Bush. And during this period of George W. Bush, you know, all of my contemporaries and friends were wringing their hands, saying, oh, George Bush is the next Hitler. You know, isn't he terrible? And I never felt that way. I mean, I didn't vote for him. But what worried me was what was going to happen when this country got into really serious trouble and the American public felt really helpless and really scared, and they begged somebody to push them around, to tell them what to do, to direct their behavior in some kind of a purposeful way, and direct their thinking in some kind of purposeful way about how are we going to continue being a country, and what kind of person might be the one who they select to do that. And I think there are a lot of candidates out there who are scary, you know, the Glenn Becks and Rush Limbaugh type of guys. I'm not saying those guys exactly, but, you know, what happens often in this kind of situation, in a situation where governments and authorities lose their legitimacy, is that all of a sudden people come out of the woodwork. You know, people you've never heard of before come out of the woodwork, and all of a sudden they're there, you know? The French Revolution was grinding on year after year. You know, and all these great figures are involved, and Robespierre, and Marat, and blah, 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 and Mirabeau, and the whole, not in that order, but this whole cavalcade of great French figures. And finally, when they're all exhausted or dead, out of the woodwork comes this 26-year-old artillery officer, who no one ever heard of before, from Corsica. You know, and he's the last guy left in Paris who appears to know what he's doing. And everybody says, oh my God, this guy seems to know what he's doing. And what I've discovered, you know, partly since writing this play, is that there are three levels of charisma, where charisma could be understood in three different levels, right? There are people who really know what they're doing, there are people who appear to know what they're doing, and there are people who pretend to know what they're doing. And we're very attracted, we find it very appealing when we find people who really know what they're doing. And sometimes people who seem to know what they're doing are almost as okay. You know, so then, you know, you get your Napoleons, you get your Hitlers, and, you know, you get your George Bushes and your Mike Huckabees, and who knows who's going to come out of the woodwork, you know. Nobody heard of Barack Obama in the year 2000. He was an unknown figure. And if we are in trouble in 4 or 5 years, and I think the window that we're talking about is, you know, I think 5 years is a pretty long window for us getting into trouble. We're going to be in trouble way before. We're already in trouble. You know, our banking system is functionally dead, only we don't know it. But, you know, long before then, the election of 2012, I mean, God knows what's going to happen. Or even before that. And that's a very long-winded answer to you. Sorry about that.
Two more questions.
I believe I'm the only person of color here. I just wanted to ask if Tom was he considered to be African American or imagined him to be. My other question was, the play by Tracy Letts, August.
This one's difficult to hear. The speaker says that he believes he's the only audience member who is a person of color and would like to know if Jim considered the character of Tom to be African American. He also says that Big Slide has a similar dynamic to August, Osage County by Tracy Letts, which is a play featuring a large family with a swirl of action. Jim says he's not actually familiar with that piece. Then Iris Simmel, who read the part of Tom, asks if he can address the first question before Jim takes it.
Yeah, I'm unfamiliar with that.
Before Mr. Kunstler answers, I'd like to say that we had a discussion about Tom's ethnicity, and we decided that he was not a person of color, that he was white, and that the term the house nigger was, although very derogatory, but it was not necessarily a racist derogatory term, but a personal insult.
No, it was very clear. I just was wondering because of his dynamic, his energy.
You'd be surprised how much we talk about.
Well, no, he was very much the sort of spiritual center I found him to be, this sort of calm. Where he could look and sort of diffuse all this tumult.
Yes.
And I just found it really interesting, and that was the question that I had, and also just the dynamics of all this swirl that you were talking about.
He is the sort of the calm center of the storm. I did envision him as being exactly what they described him as, an Adirondack woodchuck. Now, woodchuck is a derogatory term, but it also just, as a sheer descriptive term, it just means like a native, you know, person from the Adirondacks who's not an upper class person, a working class Adirondack person. And so that's what he is.
I'd like to offer this idea. Can you imagine this?
This audience member is suggesting that college drama classes should present Jim's play as a staged reading.
Well, it is. It's out of my hands, really.
Yeah. Can I address that a little bit?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
This is Michael Arvey, the director again. He says that unfortunately, the college drama departments today are really focused on trying to raise money for their departments. So they choose to do plays like Sloth Pacific and Sound of Mucus, which is just making fun of South Pacific and the Sound of Music. Over the years, he says colleges can't really afford to put on huge plays unless they can guarantee to pack the house.
If you offered this to a college, they would say, who's going to pay for it?
But I would change the title to Kittens and Puppies Go to College. Because it'll make people feel better.
What? I didn't hear that.
Kittens and Puppies Go to College.
Never work with kids and dogs.
Puppies, yeah.
Well, thank you all very much for coming. I applaud you.
Well, that's it for the special Big Slide editions of the ConcertCast. I hope you enjoyed this little break from our normal routine to hear some original drama brought to you through real actors. Hats off to the cast, crew, and to Jim himself. If you have not already, I would ask that you please consider purchasing the $5 Big Slide ebook at kunstler.com/Big Slide. It's a great read. You can get it as a PDF or for Kindle. If you'd like a different format, send me an email at letters@kunstlercast.com. This is not an NPR fund drive, but I would like to remind you that your purchase of the Big Slide ebook helps to keep programs like this podcast going and free. You may have noticed that next week is going to be the 100th episode of the Kunstlercast. I don't have anything special planned for that show, so I wanted to take a moment to thank you all now for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this program. We're going to keep going, and I hope it keeps getting better. You've been listening to the Kunstlercast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.